Tonight is the second class in our series on Genjo Koan. And let's see. This is going to be on a couple more lines. We're not going to get very far. So just as an intro, let's see. People could pass out the chant books, and the Genjo Koan is on page 49. And if you have a chant book at home, it's on page 49. And then the link was placed in the chat because this is what we recited tonight. And just been placed again in case you have missed it. So if you want to, you can pull that up. But we will be just studying a couple lines, and it's not absolutely necessary. So just as a brief reminder, so Dogen is a Zen master in our lineage. He's a Japanese monk who lived 1200 to 1253, very prolific writer. And he wrote many, many, many things, but Genjo Koan is one of, I don't know, I guess it's most, one of his most popular essays. Most of his writings are in kind of an essay form. And Genjo Koan, there's several different books on Genjo Koan, just this little relatively short text. So it's quite revered, and many of us feel that it captures much of the essence of Zen. And so our study will go line by line through this. And last week, for instance, we only went through the first three verses or sentences. And just as a reminder for the value of study, I'm a tad concerned that, you know, this class series is going to seem, I don't know, heady or overwhelming or kind of like, you know, because a lot of times, like, we just did this one on troubling emotions and we went home and it's kind of like, okay, you know, it seems more directly, it's more easily accessible to understand why is this important, why are we studying this. And I have a little bit of a worry that people will walk away from this going like, okay, what was that? However, it is, I hope you will enjoy the way I do, just wrestling with the teachings and not really worrying too much about whether you conclude that now you understand it. I mean, I was just thinking tonight as we were reciting this, that I've studied this, I've done podcast episodes on it, right? I've studied this, and it's still like, I still kind of lose, I mean, what was that again? Like, you know, there's different imagery and stuff like that. So it's not necessarily a kind of understanding that you're going to be able to grasp neatly and hold on to. You get familiar with it and you lose some of the details, but you can keep the spirit of it. And Dogen also, his works are very well approached as being like poetry, as using words and imagery, but shifting frames of reference and not something that you can necessarily follow in a linear way. But we allow it into our consciousness and not worry too much about it. Just let it affect us. And I'm also hoping that somehow I can convey through our discussions of Genjo Koan what is important here. Even if the exact meaning or the definitions and stuff might be elusive, that this is not about, you know, the importance of understanding an obscure text. It's not about the importance of knowing what Dogen meant to say, or even understanding like profound Zen teachings. It hopefully is about our life. It hopefully is about like the fundamental matter of being a human being, and trying to live this life in a meaningful way. So that is the point, even if maybe, you know, I don't manage to make that connection, that is the point. So just to revisit the title, Genjo means reality actually and presently taking place. This is according to Shohaku Okumura. He has a book, Living by Vow. Or no, he has a whole book on Genjo Koan where he talks about this. And he says Koan refers to the intersection of two aspects of reality, the individual or relative, and the universal or absolute. So he translates the title to mean to answer the question from true reality through the practice of our everyday activity. But a different set of translators, so this is Nishijima and Cross, who I love. They have their Shobogenzos in four volumes, and they tend to be a little less interpretive in their translations, and their translations are therefore a little awkward sometimes in terms of English, but they also have a lot of footnotes, so I tend to like their translations. They say Genjo means realized, and that koan expresses a law or universal principle. So they translate this as the realized universe. So part of the point I'm making is just translation is tricky. And tonight we're actually going to look at a little bit of the kanji that are used in Genjo Koan, and hopefully we'll get some of that across. My translation is honoring and manifesting the relative and absolute dimensions in your life simultaneously. And then thank you to Andrew. I think the best title of Genjo Koan so far has been Closing the Gap. Closing the gap between our sense of what is greater and our connectivity with everything, our sense that life is precious as it is, and all the rest of the stuff, all the messiness of life. So before we started on the line by line, I just wanted to take another brief stab at trying to study the or describe the these two different aspects of reality. So this is a fundamental Mahayana teaching that arose even way before Zen, that reality has there's two truths, is one of the ways that it is put. Because I tried to talk about it last week, and then I'm just like, ah, oh, it's very unsatisfying to try to explain, right? When you read koans about, teachers slapping monks upside the head, or putting a sandal on their head, or pointing at a tree in the garden or something, in a way, this is because sometimes these the independent dimension of reality is better expressed in these ways than blah 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 blah. But here we go. So the idea is that our reality has two aspects which are simultaneously true. And I like to call it two different dimensions of, because then it's like there's one reality, it just has two different dimensions. Now, one dimension is the dimension of space and time and causation. It's the dimension that goes like this, and this is, we're very aware of the dependent dimension. And the independent dimension has no dimension. It is only right here, right now. It is just this. It cannot be grasped the moment you say, oh, right, this moment, well, now, so any amount of time, any amount of abstraction brings us into the dependent dimension. So one of the points of this is that all distinctions are relative or dependent or contingent. All distinctions, good and bad, self and other. If you have, for instance, a fixed boundary that ends at your skin, It's only because it separates your body from the world around it. The only way that skin makes any sense is because it's containing something compared to the world, right? Like it, that boundary, our self does not exist without what is outside it. Again, this is like, now we're getting this dependent dimension with the explanations. But in just this moment, just right here, right now, in silence, reality does not depend on any of those relative distinctions in order to exist. Reality is fine. It does not need to be carved up into good or bad or here or there or self or other. And although this moment can never be grasped, everything in the universe is just what it is. And when we let go of our mental map of reality and experience it directly, when we really just dwell in silence for a moment, everything is indescribably and inexplicably precious. So Suzuki Roshi called this things as it is. And he spoke English as a second language. So there's this kind of assumption that he kind of misspoke there, right? Like things as they are, it should be. But I don't know. I think it might've been intentional, because things that expresses this multiplicity of things, of beings, but as it is, it's in this moment, it is one absolutely seamless reality. So we can experience this directly, and we do. And like I said last week, every one of us has intuited or tasted this in some way at some moment. And our practice is about becoming more and more familiar with this aspect of our existence. And just a note also on the term emptiness versus boundlessness or boundarylessness or suchness. These are all words that Zen uses to try to describe reality. And empty can sound quite negative. And, you know, I think it's Kaz Ta-Nehisi that translates the Heart Sutra and uses boundless instead of empty, which sounds lovely, right? So it's nicer to think of being boundless instead of empty. And they both are imperfect pointers at the reality. But what we're trying to convey with the word empty is that life, we are empty of what we assume is there. Like a glass is empty. Because you figure something could go in that glass. That's why we call it empty, because it doesn't happen to have anything in it right now. Whereas we assume that we have an inherent, enduring self-essence. So we say, we are empty. We are empty of that. That doesn't mean we are nothing, that we are nihilistic, void. We are still very much. We are. We are just empty of that self-essence we assume we have. So it's not meant to be a negative thing. It's meant to point at this assumption that we have. So let's begin on the actual verses for tonight. And then feel free to interrupt me when we're going through this. So I have a little handout for the class, and I will share my screen. Actually, I can share my screen, but I will also give you the link. I think this should be, anybody can view it. So I'm just going to share the link just in case, instead of sharing screen, you just want to pull this up on your own. And Expand the Zoom screen a little bit so I can see a few people at least. So when I was preparing for this class, what I really wished was that I read Japanese. I don't. So this is a very crude, I just haven't in my digital resources, I happen to have a copy of the Genjo Koan in the kanji for the Genjo Koan. So what I did was I just cut and pasted that for y'all. And was there an extra one of those? I just cut and pasted that for y'all. And then I looked up the kanji in this online Japanese dictionary, Tangerine, I think it's called, Tangerine. And you can just like cut and paste a kanji and then ask it to look it up. Now, to be like, the definition that I might get from that dictionary is not necessarily the definition that applies to a Buddhist text. It's modern Japanese as opposed to Dogen, but it's still kind of interesting. The main point of sharing this with you tonight is just to give you a little bit of the sense of, I find it helpful to just look at these different kanji, even though I don't speak the Japanese, to tie them together. You can see, you know, the kanji are the fairly complicated, you know, square characters, and all those other more wispy characters are the Japanese alphabet that give the words beginnings and endings and tie them together in terms of, like, you know, causality and object and subject and stuff like that. So I don't even have that. I don't even know what it says. But the first of our lines for tonight is, therefore, flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds grow even though we dislike them. And then Nishijima and Cross interpret the same line as, and though it is like this, it is only that flowers, while loved, fall, and weeds, while hated, flourish. So I find it interesting that their translation does not imply causality. So Okamura says, therefore, flowers fall even though we love them. Whereas Nishijima and Cross say, and although, so this is following up those first three verses of the Genjo Koan, which present these different aspects of Buddhist practice. One, you know, there's practice, we practice to end suffering and to increase wisdom and compassion, and there's Buddhas who are, you know, are further ahead on the path than us and teach us, and, you know, there's practice. You know, that none of us would have gotten into this if it wasn't for the effectiveness of practice. And then the second verse is about, essentially about emptiness, that this is all of this is just us parsing out this seamless reality and abstracting, including our practice itself, Buddhas and practice and enlightenment, and all this in some ways is all just mental constructions. And so we see the emptiness of things. We see that reality, which is seamless and without distinction. But then there's a third verse, which says, and there is practice, and there are Buddhas, and there's living beings, and all of that. So it's like this is a tale of practice. When we first come into practice, we're trying to improve our lives. Then we might awaken to this aspect in which everything is precious just as it is. But that's not the entirety. That's just one side. So those two dimensions are just two dimensions of one reality. And in that one reality, we live our lives and we practice and we take care of things. Da, da, da. So that those first three verses really summarize, okay, this is our Buddhist practice, these different aspects of it, followed by this, and though it is like this, it is only that flowers, while loved, fall, and weeds, while hated, flourish. So what is this line about? To some extent, we could say that this is about pain versus dukkha. Dukkha being that extra suffering that we pile on top of things, that life is inevitably going to involve some pain, physical, mental, emotional pain, and that that is not really all that terrible. It's painful, but what's really awful, what drives us to madness and distraction and harmful behaviors and all of that is this dukkha, is this resistance to things as it is. So to some extent, this is pointing to the fact that even though we practice, we're going to experience the loss of things that we love, and we're going to experience I have to endure things that are difficult. So I like to imagine, but even deeper than that, I think this is pointing at, you know, the things that we really love in our lives, true love, caring, responsibility, versus the weeds of bad habits and barriers to intimacy, addictions or cruelty and violence, and not just within our own lives, but in the world around us. So life, if flowers fall, even though we love them, weeds while hated flourish. So what is the question that is being addressed here? You know, why did Dogen include this line? So I was trying to imagine this was Jeopardy, and this was the answer. This was the answer, and now we have to think, like, what was the question? why was this? So as I've encouraged many of you, so if you're at all curious about Dogen, to just take some of these lines and then translate them, like using your own language. You can't copy any of the words. You can't use any of the same words, and you just have to rephrase it, explain it to yourself. So I did that and I said, although the practice of the Buddha way is profoundly liberating, we still experience the pain of losing what we love and having to endure what is terrible. And when I think about what might be the question, I think, what is the nature of our practice? What is the nature of liberation? Does practice give you a perspective that makes life less painful? Does it help you navigate your life better so you can avoid or postpone some of that loss, or avoid experiencing what is awful? Does it help you care less? And if the practice doesn't make the sometimes excruciating pain of life go away, what good is it? So it's helpful to try to dredge up a question, not about, and that, you know, not just any kind of, I mean, any kind of question is fine, but thinking not so much a question about how, in a practical sense, how to live your everyday life in a skillful way. If we look at it like that, we might think this is a message of that, well, flowers when loved fall and weeds when hated still flourish, so don't be too attached to things, and don't, you know, just understand that things are going to change and don't get too upset. But that's not what this is about. I mean, that may be a useful approach to take, but I think of that as, that's like being about symptoms, as opposed to the core issue. So we can try to manage our emotions and our attitudes, or, you know, have practices we do where we try to, you know, I don't know, like, let's say practice gratitude for a while and that helps calm me down or something. Those are, you know, those are this about skillful practice. But the questions that Dogen is addressing are much more fundamental to our human existential angst, our core motivations and concerns, the great matter of our life and what it means to be human. So this answer tells us that we are not going to escape into the independent dimension somehow. So this independent dimension that I was describing, where, you know, just this moment, everything is precious just as it is. There's, you know, nothing is separate from anything else. It can be a very joyous and liberating way to be able to see. When people describe having a personal taste of this, what's usually described is they like look down at their hands, or I know one guy who was in a retreat and he just looked down at the tomato can of tomatoes and started to weep. Because you just, it's like the filter of all the self-concern and all the discriminations falls away, and we see things directly and we're like, wow. I mean, it's just, it's a miracle anything is even here, you know, just there. So that is a wonderful and liberating experience. But this is not the two dimensions are just, they're two sides of the same coin. The like one foot and the other in walking. There's all kinds of Zen metaphors for this to point toward. And I call it as like they're just two dimensions of the same reality, blah, blah, blah. They're not separate, right? So even though there is this aspect in which everything is precious just as it is, even though that is so, flowers while loved fall, weeds while hated flourish. And it's not telling us to not love the flowers or not hate the weeds. Just saying, yeah, this is the way life is. And so it really raises this question of what the nature of our practice really is. If we don't get to escape into the independent realm, if we don't find some way where we don't really, where we're kind of insulated from the pain, what is it that we are looking for? The promise of practice is very grand. We have a practice of Buddhahood, of awakening, of liberation. We intuit that this is so, that it's possible. Or we have deep faith, or we see it in others, or we've experienced our own small steps of liberation and have a sense that this keeps going. So there is something here, but what is it? This section made me think of when I was pretty new to practice and I was at Dharmarain Zen Center, and I overheard two of my Dharma seniors by lots of years converse. And one of them asked the other, said, oh, you know, how you been lately? And I heard this woman who'd been practicing for 10 years and was, you know, a senior at the center. And she was like, I've been awful. And as a beginner, I heard this, I'm like, what? Man, what? Like, you've been awful. Like, what am I doing this for? If like 10 years down the road and you're awful. But, you know, I think if you have practiced for some time, you might have a sense of what was going on there, that you can be awful and be okay in a strange way. So like the Benefit of our practice is kind of a strange benefit. It's kind of subtle. It's really, really makes a huge difference and is really profound, but it's not necessarily what we think it will be. So, anything else that you see in this passage before I go on to the next sentence or two? Yeah.
I had been wondering about.
Oh, will you come up here so that the cloud people can hear you?
Just, I guess, briefly, this reminds me of a question I had about memories. Mm-hmm. And so this is timely because it's about, you know, the moment, but then that moment turns into a memory really fast. So what is the conceptual way that is advised to think about things that are in the past?
I guess so you're saying, like, how do we relate to memories without just getting kind of just falling into the fallacy that somehow they really, the past is no more?
Yeah, whatever you want to say. Okay.
I guess the first thing that springs to my mind is that when we talk about the, you know, this seamless reality, there's also no boundary in time. And there's a way that even though, you know, on this one dimension, there's causality and there's these things that aren't around anymore and they have made changes in us. But it's like in this moment, in a way, all of those things are present. Like the results of all of them are present. We are connected, and we are connected to the future as well. So I think of that in terms of like the memories, when we relate to the memories in a practice-oriented sense, they are our reality right now. They're not really about the past. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, we only have 15 minutes left, so I better get on to conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment. And this is really the one that why I got the kanji, because I was like, So Shohaku Okamura says, conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. And then Nishijima and Cross say, driving ourselves to practice and experience the myriad dharmas is delusion. When the myriad dharmas actively practice and experience ourselves, that is the state of realization. And then yet another translation by Heejin Kim, to exert and verify myriad dharmas by carrying forth the self is illusion. To exert and verify the self while myriad dharmas come forth is enlightenment. So as you can see, we have jiko, which is oneself. And then the next thing is, sorry, I don't know if you hear the sirens. So there's two characters there. There's 10,000, and then there's dharmas. So 10,000 is a shorthand for everything. That's why it's often translated as myriad, just all that, like Suzuki Roshi's things as it is, you know, all that stuff, all the stuff. So 10,000 dharmas is all the stuff. And then this discipline further down and proof, evidence. So I believe the discipline character is what's translated as practice. And then this proof, evidence, testify, verify, guarantee, witness, I think is what is translated as enlightenment. It's not the term that's often used in other places in Buddhist literature for enlightenment, but it's a way of phrasing it, I guess. And then astray, be perplexed, in doubt, lost, error, delusion. So you see there's that first sentence and then there's the comma. So oneself, 10,000 dharmas, you know, practice enlightenment, delusion. And then as this is what I love about the getting this poetic sense, is that oftentimes what Dogen's doing is just taking these same characters and putting them in a different order. Now they're tied together a little bit with some of the Japanese, but it's Japanese and Chinese are much less dependent, like English is, on these like word order and who's doing what to who. You know, English is a good engineering language. Whereas what Dogen is often taking these is just, there's the same characters, and it's just like boop, boop. So if you just think, there's oneself, there's the 10,000 dharmas, there's practice enlightenment, and we think it goes us, practice enlightenment, 10,000 dharmas, but it actually goes 10,000 dharmas, practice enlightenment, self. So.
Domino, it's Betty. Domino, huh? can you scroll down on your screen?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was figuring you guys had.
I think some people don't. And it
This
will show up on the video.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for reminding me of that. Okay, there you go. So we have oneself, 10,000 dharmas, practice enlightenment, delusion is delusion. But then if you switch it and it's 10,000 dharmas, the self, or practice enlightenment, the self. And it, interestingly, the phrase, as far as I can tell, does not say, and that's enlightenment. I guess it just must perhaps be assumed because it says, this is delusion. Do this. So what are we doing when we are doing this wrong? When we're starting up, here's the self, here's practice enlightenment, and then we're headed to the 10,000 dharmas. This is how we engage the world, right? I'm going to go out there and I'm going to engage the 10,000 dharmas like this. As opposed to, here's the 10,000 dharmas, somehow they're doing practice enlightenment, and then the self is realized through that, or sometimes I've heard it said it's verified through the 10,000 things. We become who we are through the practice enlightenment of the 10,000 things. So to just kind of bring this down to earth a little bit, as I talked about in my podcast episode, I have a practice story about myself that I feel conveys a little bit of this. So I talked about my story of oneness with a flower. So thinking before practice, right, we're just like, oh, that's a pretty flower or whatever. I mean, maybe we like flowers, maybe we don't, whatever. But we're self-absorbed. We figure when we look at a flower, okay, there it is. I mean, we're not thinking very deeply about it, right? It's just, we take things at face value. Basically, we're very aware of the dependent dimension and not much else. But then at some point, because of our own experience of impermanence or some kind of moment of insight, perhaps, or we read something or we hear something, or you know, something makes us start to go, you know, I feel like there's something more. And then maybe you get involved in something like Zen, and then you hear people talking about, like, and you're just the separateness is something you create in your own mind, and really all things is one seamless reality, and like, you know, they describe emptiness and suchness and all these things, and then you're like, okay, I'm gonna sit, I'm gonna look at this flower, I'm gonna try to drop my sense of self, right? I'm gonna try to just like let go of my mental map of reality and try to just experience directly, just, you know, be one with this flower. And then it doesn't work. You know, like, oh, sit there for hours, just like, come on. But still, no matter what, there's just a self sitting there trying to be one with the flower, you know? And it's, is this it? Is that it? What? And so it, at that point in our practice, we're like, we're trying hard, but there's still something, we feel like there's something obstructing us. But that's because, of course, like Dogen's saying, we are like, okay, I am going to practice now. I'm going to go out and become one with the 10,000 things. And this, I think, is something we have to do. We have to try. We can't just take a shortcut and go, well, I'm not going to fall into that trap. I'm just going to let go. But like, we don't know what that really means until we try, until we explore this sense of separation from things. Anyway, what I feel like is that I just had to exhaust myself doing that. This isn't gonna happen. This just like kind of give up, right? But not giving up practice, but just giving up the self-centered agenda in practice, right? Giving up the sense of like, well, I want to experience this. I want to understand this. I want to be relieved of my suffering. So like, as long as we bring all of that to our practice, then it's going to be the delusion, right? And then it's like in a moment of letting go and relaxation, it's just like, it's just all right there. I mean, the flower, the 10,000 things, they haven't been running away like, you don't get to be one with us. It was all just right there from the beginning, and we were dreaming up the separation.
The can of tomatoes.
Just look at it, and there. It's offering us, it's offering itself. Everything is offering itself to us in every moment. So I had a little poem that I like to summarize it with, which was, the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors are written in all the atoms and cells, and each manifestation loudly proclaims the truth by its very existence. But actually, no comment is necessary. It's just things as they are. Right, so we have a few minutes. We have 6 minutes to discuss the nature of enlightenment and intimacy and what Dogen meant. I mean, here it is. I shouldn't have tried to do two sentences. We should have just stuck with one sentence. But there it is. If you have any, in particular, you know, looking at these characters, the conveying, you know, the one self and the 10,000 dharmas and the practice enlightenment, if there's any thoughts you have on the meaning of that, or anything that has occurred to you or something, please share. And if you're in the cloud, raise your hand or just unmute yourself. If you're in the Zendo, just come up here.
To me, what I kind of got out of that first sentence, the flowers fall even though we love them and weeds grow even though we dislike them. What I got was like, what is dependent, what is independent? So like the flowers and the weeds, those are the things that's like kind of actual reality. And then the stuff that we put on them is like what comes next. And then if you bring that into the second sentence, that we talked about, like trying to become reality in the universe, that is, you know, trying to like understand and trying to become more of the universe is where you'll go wrong. But trying to become yourself and like truly the actual person, then you become your function of self, with which is a function of the universe. So that's how you become the bigger thing, is by being the thing that you actually are.
And that's actually a foreshadowing to places later in the Genjo Koan, where he really is talking about like, how is it that a limited being can somehow like realize this profound stuff? And, you know, he says like the fish cannot leave the water and the bird cannot leave the air. And yet you can know it. You can know it because you are part of it. Right. People enjoy seeing the way the characters move around. It makes him seem a lot less complicated when you realize he just had like four words and just moved them around in a sentence.
Chip raised his hand.
Oh, Chip, your hand blends into your wall. Go ahead.
Yeah, similar to Charles, I guess I thought like no matter what we want or don't want or like or dislike, flowers will fall and weeds will still grow. And similarly, wanting and practice is not really going to cut it, in a sense. Flowers will still be flowers and weeds will still be weeds. So be a flower, be a weed.
Thank you. Adine.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I remember when I first read this, this line about the flowers and the weeds, years ago, and I was still living in San Francisco, I saw this weed that was growing up in the sidewalk, in the cracks of the sidewalk. And for some reason, I was just thinking, who am I to, you know, thinking about Genjo Koan, thinking, who am I to say, I hate this, but I love the flower? But anyway, I just wanted to share that.
And I like the line that it, like I said, it doesn't say don't love stuff and don't hate stuff. It's almost like this nod that, like, you know, we're human beings and we got to make judgment calls. And so that's going to be the nature of our life. But if we don't have to think that those judgments are inherently, they have some inherent fixed truth about them. And in particular, you know, I guess when you think about, all right, say we're appreciating the independent dimension of reality. And for many of us, the first place our mind goes is like, well, what about this terrible stuff? And what about that terrible stuff? What do you mean? How can it all be precious just as it is when that terrible stuff? And it's like, there, that's a very strong temptation, right? To just like, and then we're getting pulled into the dependent dimension, which is fine. Like, we live our lives there and we have to make our decisions there. But along the independent dimension, you know, making the distinction between something painful or terrible or unjust and something beautiful and sweet is it's just as arbitrary as deciding the dandelion's a weed and this is a flower. Like, we put that on, and that's, but we're not, the tricky thing is, and the book Gendro Cohen isn't really about this. We have to remember to never put these at odds with each other. I get very nervous, and like, as soon as we start talking about it, and everything is precious, just as this, I'm like, wait a second, you know, because I don't want the independent dimension to be used as an excuse for passivity, and for letting things be. It's like, no, absolutely not. Do not use it that way. But at the same time, there's solace to be found in being able to just perceive the world without carving it up into those categories, and just recognize that there's no expectations. No one said anything should be some particular way. The fact that any atom in this entire universe exists is a miracle. And to be able to perceive things that way is a source of great strength. So I'll leave it there. Offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.